You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of NYPD Confidential by Adam Sierowski, with photographs by Mark Salliger. The previous evening, as the Iranian president's motorcade was en route to JFK Airport to head back home, an IRGC bodyguard had indicated to authorities that he'd left his weapon at his hotel in Midtown. The Iranians requested that their assigned NYPD security detail retrieve it and bring it to their plane before takeoff. That was a non-starter. Instead, officers were dispatched to the hotel room, where they found not only a knockoff Glock with two loaded magazines, but also an encrypted two-way radio bearing the words "property of the IRGC." Eyes went wide around the room as the group considered the meaning and timing of the incident. Shortly thereafter, as I drove with Weiner to base camp for UNGA operations, Netanyahu's heavily armed convoy whizzed by in the opposite direction. She didn't miss a beat, wondering aloud, "Imagine if the IRGC guy killed somebody. That would have been a big deal." Her team had turned the gun and radio over to the FBI. When I revisited the topic with her later, she said, "We are worried about them killing Trump at the same time that we're also being called up from a car and asked to return their property. As my 9-year-old would say, it's very ironical." Hours after the intelligence briefing, and in a seemingly unrelated development, officials in Washington announced a $20 million reward for information leading to the arrest or conviction of an IRGC operative, Sharam Poursafi, who, according to the FBI, used encrypted internet-based messaging applications to hire criminal elements within the United States to murder a former USG official in Washington, D.C., or Maryland, in exchange for $300,000. John Bolton, Trump's former national security advisor, was the unnamed target. But as I would come to learn, he was hardly the only one. In January, during his first week in office, Trump reportedly ordered that security details be rescinded for Bolton, ex-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and Pompeo's former deputy Brian Hook, even in the face of apparently ongoing Iranian threats. Kelly's crew. To understand why Weiner is the consummate heavy for this moment, it helps to understand the story of the unit she now heads and how it fits into her career trajectory. The tale begins, as many do, on September 11, 2001. It starts with the guy who would eventually hire Weiner a year out of Harvard Law. At the time, Dave Cohen was settling into one of life's elusive second acts after 3 decades at the CIA, where he had risen to become the agency's deputy director for operations. "It's historically the best job in Washington," he explained. "You're the head of America's clandestine service. Nothing matches that." But he and his wife were ready to shift gears. So he took a position in New York as an advisor to Hank Greenberg at the insurance juggernaut AIG, where, at long last, the stakes were low and the pay was high. Then the Twin Towers were attacked, and Cohen's old life came roaring back with a vengeance. "I knew we were at war," he said. "After all, in the days when he was America's top spy, 3 years after the first assault on the World Trade Center in 1993, He had helped establish the CIA's Bin Laden issue station, later nicknamed Alex Station, which was tasked with tracing the tendrils of Al-Qaeda. When Michael Bloomberg was elected mayor in late 2001, he appointed Ray Kelly to his second stint as NYPD commissioner. Kelly was already familiar with a landscape that, in Lower Manhattan anyway, had become a hellscape. Bloomberg, in fact, plucked Kelly from his own cushy gig at Bear Stearns, where he reported to CEO Ace Greenberg. As crews raced around the clock to recover remains from Ground Zero, Kelly reached out to Cohen, who recalled that Kelly cut to the chase. He said, "I'm going to rebuild the NYPD to deal with the terrorist threat, and I'd like you to come in and join me." Pushing back politely, Cohen insisted he didn't want to leave his new boss, Hank Greenberg, hanging. But Kelly wasn't having it, Cohen laughed. Without missing a beat, he said, Yeah, you have your Greenberg problems. I have mine." The former spy chief felt obligated. With the city still smoldering, he knew he had two options: take the job or leave town. In January 2002, the CIA veteran took over an intelligence unit that originated in the early 1900s. It was literally a backwater, relegated to the World War I-era Brooklyn Army Terminal, derided as the Bat. "It was pretty much an armpit," Cohen recounted. "The most important thing that ever came out of the Bat?" That's where Elvis Presley, drafted into the Army in 1957, deployed from when he went to Germany. But even a star turn could not mask the obvious. NYPD intel was a world away from the department's center of gravity across the river in Manhattan. When Cohen finally finagled an office at 1PP, the administrative overlords relegated the former spy chief to room 301, a storage area chock full of investigative reports dating back to 1901. He squeezed into a space that was, in his words, closet-sized, barely big enough for a desk and a handful of chairs. "I treated 301 as a status symbol. I didn't want to meld in with the rest of the department. It was important to sustain the mystique." But he had something that most of the brass did not: the commissioner's ear. Every day, he had a standing 8 a.m. appointment with Kelly, and everybody knew it. Proximity to power only amplified Cohen's cachet. He and his boss had a mindset of building their agency along the lines of the OSS, Cohen told me. Referring to the Office of Strategic Services, the CIA's nimble World War II predecessor. "We're going to have an analytical program, an operational program, a deep cover program. As needs arose," he would add, "a cyber capability, a surveillance capability. All of these were sort of bricks in a wall." It was a complete paradigm shift. Mitch Silber, one of Cohen's early hires, who became his director of intelligence analysis, explained, "Historically, in a police department, the motto is collars for dollars. You bring a case for prosecution, and then you get promoted, and then you get more dollars. So the idea that you would run a long-term intelligence collection investigation for a few years, and therefore there would be no collars, and therefore there would be no dollars, was a shock to the culture." Cohen's bureau placed a premium on human intelligence, HUMINT, derived from undercover officers, UCs, and confidential informants, CIs. The collection of open-source intelligence, OSINT, and a strong team of analysts to make sense of it all. He quickly recognized the built-in advantage of a department that could draw on 36,000 cops conversant in 168 languages. His crown jewel, though, was the Special Services Unit, SSU, a group whose name has never been disclosed in the mainstream press. They were the pointy end of the spear, he said. The deep cover program enabled you to get inside the operations of a terror cell. By design, it was a separate and stealthy enterprise. Cohen and company scoured applications from the post 9/11 legions looking to join the NYPD and plucked individuals from non-traditional backgrounds who, in spy jargon, could live their cover. Once selected for the SSU, they never were allowed to walk into an NYPD facility, Cohen asserted. We didn't want them to learn police jargon. We didn't want them going to dinner, say, with assets or targets and asking for a receipt. No, you don't need a receipt if you're coming with us. They were Afghans, Pakistanis, Egyptians, you name it. We took full advantage, in a positive way, of what the city had to offer. The unit quickly encountered resistance from a formidable opponent, the FBI. Though the NYPD and the Bureau had worked together for ages, Kelly needed a team he could run and trust post 9/11. From our vantage, Silber recalled, the feds had failed in 1993 and in 2001. If there was another plot, we feared there would be a massive capital flight from the city. To be fair, the FBI had already been thoroughly excoriated for its failure to connect the 9/11 dots or play nice with other government agencies. The CIA, Alex Station in particular, which bore Cohen's fingerprints, had also been taken to the woodshed for siloing critical information that might have thwarted or blunted the attack. Full disclosure, I began my career as an attorney in the CIA's Office of General Counsel. Cohen's outfit ruffled feathers among Washington's national security set, nowhere more so than at the FBI. Skirmishes over information sharing metastasized into turf battles. We were intruders into their area of responsibility, Cohen said. But they couldn't do what we could do. The disparity was glaring. In the early aughts, the FBI had roughly 12,000 special agents spread across 56 domestic field offices and 45 U.S. posts abroad. In contrast, the NYPD had three times as many officers operating within the five boroughs alone. Things came to a head in August 2004 when a confidential informant secretly recorded two men plotting to bomb the Herald Square subway station. We actually stopped a terrorist attack, Cohen said. The Bureau didn't take it seriously. They were wrong. They didn't think we could do it. They were wrong. And this was like 2 weeks before the Republican National Convention and a couple of blocks away. This was a big, big deal. The primary defendant, Shahrwar Mateen Siraj, was sentenced to 30 years for conspiring to plant explosives. That was really the first case, Silber noted, that proved that the NYPD Intelligence Division could bring value that was unique and distinct. Weiner fit neatly into this scrappy yet evolving team. In 2006, as a Harvard International Security Fellow, she was writing a paper on the risk government face by outsourcing to private military contractors. One day, she happened to attend a panel called Policing in a Time of Terror. Ray Kelly was among the participants and mentioned the unit that he and Cohen had set up. After the talk, Weiner approached him and said she wanted to work there. The next day, she got a call, and Cohen brought her on as an intelligence analyst. In short order, Weiner found herself in a cop shop, armed with a law degree and her expertise in foreign affairs, biotech, and nuclear deterrence, as well as her knowledge of the threat posed by radical Islamist groups and the so-called lone wolves they help inspire or recruit. Cohen's tenure was not without controversy. At one point, he created a so-called demographics unit intended to chart different New York-based diaspora communities, hoping to help identify where a potential militant might go to blend in. Or, as Silber put it, we knew that in Madrid in the 2004 train attack, people hung out at a certain barbershop. Some of the guys got together for 7-7, the 2005 London bombings, in a bookstore in Leeds. Where were those places in New York? Where was the cafe where hotheads get together to talk about doing something? What may have made sense on paper, however, was pegged as anti-Islamic. It morphed into an unmitigated legal and PR disaster. Plainclothes officers visited majority Muslim neighborhoods, which opened the department up to allegations of racial and religious profiling, as well as a full-blown domestic spying scandal, one that the Associated Press earned a 2012 Pulitzer Prize for exposing. Weiner was conscripted to help handle the NYPD's negotiations with attorneys for Muslim leaders. The main takeaway is to actually show your hand a bit more, Weiner explained, looking back. Part of the issue was the perception of what you're hiding is going to be much more scary and terrible than the reality of what you're doing here. Perhaps Cohen's most audacious gambit, which happened to dovetail with Weiner's interest, occurred sub rosa. He quietly established a program to place detectives in key locations overseas. Their role was to provide intelligence on ever-changing terror tactics, as well as early warnings of potential threats to the city. From his CIA days, Cohen had strong relationships with foreign intelligence and law enforcement officials, and knew plenty of American ambassadors. Even so, he realized that putting members of a metropolitan police force in a U.S. embassy, or anywhere in a foreign country, would draw fire from the feds. But having come from a world where risk was rewarded, he went for it. Cohen, in an early instance, persuaded Spain's national police to host a hard-charging young detective who spoke impeccable Castilian Spanish. They agreed, but evidently made the mistake of calling U.S. embassy officials to see if they would mind. Cohen grimaced as he recalled the earful Madrid got from an American diplomat. "Absolutely we mind. Don't do it." When Cohen broke the news to Kelly, Cohen remembered, the commissioner didn't bat an eye. He purportedly barked, "Send him anyway." Today, the NYPD has liaison officers in cities from Abu Dhabi to Bogota, The Hague to Tel Aviv, and Weiner has been a linchpin. She helped foreign counterparts track cells or crack cases, created an intel and threat analysis program that would become an industry model, and became the first senior member of a local police force to serve on America's National Intelligence Council. In 2014, Cohen handed over the reins to John Miller, now CNN's chief law enforcement and intelligence analyst, who knew the terrain. As a senior FBI official, he'd witnessed the acrimony between the department and the feds. Steeped in both cultures, he spearheaded an effort to get the cops and the G-men, as he put it, to stop knocking heads. Under Miller, the FBI began ramping up its use of SSU's pool of undercovers. Federal agents tended to be older, more square. Miller's, and now Weiner's, were younger, more diverse, multilingual. The FBI's former special agent in charge of counterterrorism in New York, Brian Parman, gave me the rationale. Your average FBI agent is hired around age 30. By the time he has his investigative chops and has gone through undercover school and is certified, he may be closer to early 40s. But if you're talking about a group of young radicals, how do you infiltrate when those guys are 22? The answer? Tap into the NYPD's ranks. Over time, that collaboration, almost entirely invisible to the public, expanded nationwide. We started to cross-certify our undercovers into their program, Miller said of the FBI. We became basically an extension of the efforts to protect other American cities from terrorism. In one such case, eerily similar to the recent New Year's massacre in New Orleans, a 25-year-old from Texas caught ICB attention in early 2022. Our undercover finds this guy online who is so aggressive, Weiner said. The undercover agent starts courting him, posing as a kindred radical. Among other things, according to a federal criminal complaint, the man shares a video clip of himself driving his Ford F-250 pickup alongside a populated area. He can be heard cursing non-Muslims as ISIS propaganda music plays in the background. Within a couple of weeks, he's got his videotaped pledge of allegiance to ISIS and invites us out to Texas to do some casing of these bars that are on this strip. By this point, with the FBI in the lead, the NYPD's undercover traveled to meet the suspect in person. He told us he's looking to carry out an attack on this outdoor pedestrian area in Dallas, Weiner continued. Moving quickly, Miller said, the FBI took the guy down on the road because they said we've got too much threat, too much capability. The case, he noted, was a prime example of a fast-moving plot that looked like it was imminent and had to be stopped, and where the only person who could get into the guy was the NYPD undercover. The man in question ended up pleading to a charge of conspiracy to distribute narcotics and will spend years behind bars. While ISIS was a constant worry, so too were new threats from potential attackers aligned with Iran. In a prescient move, Miller tasked Weiner, then his director of intelligence analysis, with charting Iran's capabilities on the ground in New York City. He remembered being struck that she came up with this brilliant report which strung together all of these connections that, had the federal government done it, would have been highly classified. But it was all based on NYPD casework, our first clear look into what Iran was up to with Hezbollah and other operators mapping targets in New York. It was only a matter of time before Weiner's hour would arrive. In July 2023, during a delicate politicized period, she emerged as a consensus candidate to be Miller's successor. In appointing her, Mayor Adams noted that protecting the nation was in her blood. Today, she is following in her grandfather's legacy and protecting our city and our nation's security. This is the American dream. She was soon busy covering the proverbial waterfront, from signing off on security protocols for the Met Gala to monitoring ISIS activities. Last April, Weiner was involved in the decision-making when, at the request of Columbia University, the NYPD would dispatch the emergency service unit to the campus to dislodge pro-Palestinian protesters who had occupied Hamilton Hall. It didn't hurt that she's been a Columbia adjunct associate professor. It also didn't hurt that her family upbringing reinforced an instinct, as the saying goes, to help keep the peace. Or that she has maintained throughout her career a fixed moral compass, an important attribute at a time when several members of the mayor's administration, including two ex-police commissioners, are under federal investigation for corruption, though no charges have been filed. Cohen, now 82, echoed Adams' assessment of Weiner, turning animated when he spoke of the young analyst he'd hired and mentored. What I would say to all of us who would claim some credit for her success, don't. You didn't do shit for her. She's a star, and I might add the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, keeping in mind her grandfather. Victim 4, Donald Trump. In my talks with Weiner and her cohorts, their frequent references to Iranian lethal plotting were puzzling. The phrase came up consistently, yet obliquely. The gun and encrypted walkie-talkie that the Iranian aide had left in the hotel room had caught my attention, but mainly as an oddity. Then, on October 14th, after two failed attempts on Trump's life, along with the excoriation of the Secret Service from many quarters, Biden officials went public with a pronouncement that stopped me cold. They said they'd conveyed multiple warnings to their Iranian counterparts that any attempt on the welfare of then-candidate Trump would be considered by the United States as an act of war. I asked Weiner for the lowdown. The Iranian government, she said, has been trying to kill either U.S. government officials or prominent activists in retribution for Soleimani, the head of the Quds Force. This threat has been going on since 2020, and there's a lot of different tentacles. She listed people who, based on NYPD and U.S. intelligence, have been among Tehran's targets. First and foremost was Trump. Others included Bolton, Pompeo, and former CENTCOM commander Frank McKenzie. They also want to kill Iranian dissidents. So Masai's part of that threat stream. Masai Ali-Nejad, who had been residing in the New York City area, is an Iranian-American journalist and activist whose withering criticism of the Tehran regime, including its human rights abuses and rampant corruption, has made her a prime assassination target. In June 2020, authorities contend a team of Iranian agents allegedly mobilized with the intention of kidnapping her in a scheme that appeared to involve taking her by boat from the New York waterfront and transporting her by sea to Venezuela. From there, according to a federal indictment, she would have been flown to Tehran. Based on interviews with federal and local law enforcement representatives, as well as court records, Iran's alleged assassination efforts in the U.S. would grow bolder in the lead-up to the election. As far-fetched as the plot against Ali-Nejad may sound, its accused mastermind, Alireza Shavaraghi Farahani, purportedly kept on one of his electronic devices a picture of Ali-Nejad with two other dissidents, Ruhollah and Jarnshid Sharmad, along with an ominous caption in Farsi, "Are you coming, or should we come for you?" Though the plans for Ali-Nejad came to naught, Zam and Sharmad were successfully lured from their homes in France and California, respectively, abducted and taken to Iran, where they were executed. In July 2021, the Southern District of New York indicted Farahani and his alleged co-conspirators on counts involving kidnapping, bank and wire fraud, money laundering, and sanctions violations. Then, on July 28, 2022, a patrol car pulled over a Subaru Forester SUV that a surveillance camera had spotted near a residence associated with Ali-Nejad. The driver had staked out the location and had even ordered Uber Eats while sitting behind the wheel. When NYPD officers searched the vehicle, they found a loaded AK-47-style assault rifle, 5 dozen rounds of ammunition, more than $1,000 in cash, and a black ski mask. They arrested Khalid Medvedev, a Yonkers resident, and member of a Eurasian organized crime crew known as the Thieves in Law. The group's emblem is an 8-pointed black and white star, which adherents emblazon on everything from their bodies to birthday cakes. that is said to symbolize that they will kneel before no one. In due course, authorities located Mediev's purported fellow thieves, Rafat Amirov and Polad Amirov, since extradited, as well as Zialat Mamedov. Federal prosecutors allege that the men were hired by an IRGC Brigadier General, Ruhollah Bazgarani, and given a singular mission to kill Alinejad. Moments before he was pulled over, Mediev is said to have sent Omarov a video from inside his car, displaying his assault rifle, along with a message, "We are ready." "The Iranians have a whole history of assassinating people," Weiner said. "Each plot looks a little bit different, but usually involves some kind of cutout, a hired gun with no obvious ties to the recruiter. It's a little bit of a throw noodles on the wall kind of mentality. The reason they've gone to this model is for plausible deniability. And yet, they want people with connections. Meaning experienced criminals willing to do both the crime and the time, or have associates who would. That was evident in 2023 when Tehran, according to the Justice Department, turned to a 51-year-old IRGC asset named Farhad Shakari, who was born in Afghanistan but moved to the U.S. as a child. In his 20s, he was convicted of robbery in New York and served 14 years in state penitentiaries, including Fishkill, which is where he met Carlisle Rivera, a.k.a. Pop, who was there on a second-degree murder rap. In 2008, Shakari was deported, only to be imprisoned a decade later in Colombo, Sri Lanka, in connection with the seizure of nearly 100 kilos of heroin. Somewhere along the line, he was recruited by the IRGC and wound up living in Iran. As the U.S. entered the 2024 election cycle, and with the Middle East in chaos, Shakari allegedly contacted Rivera and an associate of his, Jonathan Lodholt, with a proposition: $100,000 to locate and rub out Alinejad. The hired guns began surveilling the activist, traveling to Connecticut, where she was scheduled to speak that February. The event was canceled at the urging of law enforcement. Rivera and Lodholt, however, were undeterred, and it seems well armed. Photos retrieved from their devices appear to show an arsenal of assault rifles, firearms, and a shotgun. The men also exhibited tradecraft that had eluded the more penny-ante thieves in law. Rivera had procured a burner phone paying cash. Lodholt seems to have taken pains to remove the South Carolina license plates on his black 2007 Honda Accord. The duo, on multiple occasions that spring, evidently cased and photographed Alinejad's property. They were clever, but not clever enough. Despite these precautions, the vehicle was spotted by specialized cameras on the Verrazano Bridge nearly every time it moved between Staten Island, where Lodholt lived, and Alinejad's home. Cell site location data revealed a pattern. When they were on a stakeout, the men would leave their phones behind and fire up the burner when they were closer to their target. Meanwhile, the same pole camera that triggered Mediev's arrest recorded Lodholt's Accord parked in various spots around the dissident's residence. From his perch in Tehran, authorities believe, Shakari kept tabs on developments through voice notes that he exchanged with his old friend Pop from Fishkill, who, in April, sent Shakari an update. "This bitch is hard to catch, bro, and because she hard to catch, there ain't gonna be no simple pull-up, unless there's the luck of the draw." Luck was in short supply. A joint counterterrorism task force, composed of FBI agents and Weiner's detectives, was watching Rivera and Lodholt, ever mindful that Iran, for the third time in 3 years, was targeting the same person in the same borough. At the same time, Weiner recounted, our intel and counterterrorism people were doing a lot of protective work on her. As prominent as she was, Ahlinejad was not a current or former U.S. official and therefore not entitled to 24/7 security from the feds. So the NYPD's Critical Response Command stepped in, deploying well-armed covert and overt teams that, as Weiner put it, were making sure nobody was trying to whack her. While short on specifics, FBI Director Christopher Wray telegraphed the precarious security situation. In late 2023, he had told the Senate Judiciary Committee, I see blinking lights everywhere. In April 2024, he spoke of a heightened threat environment at a House Appropriations Committee hearing, noting, looking back over my career in law enforcement, I would be hard-pressed to think of a time where so many threats to public safety and national security were so elevated all at once. It wasn't just a lone dissident in Iran's crosshairs. That same month, an elusive Pakistani man named Asif Merchant landed in Houston on a flight from Istanbul. His travel records showed that he had made frequent trips to Iraq and Syria, as well as Iran, where he had a wife and children. Purporting to be in the yarn-dyed clothing business, according to federal records, he flew to LaGuardia last June to see an individual he had been pitching from afar about a job that could net him $100,000. The pair met in a hotel room in Nassau County, where Merchant insisted they place their electronics in a drawer so as not to be monitored. What Merchant did not appreciate, however, was that his contact had already tipped off the FBI and been signed up as a confidential source. The room was wired, and a camera was rolling as Merchant asked the CS to be a middleman for him. Merchant instructed him to hire hitmen to kill a prominent person, whom he described as a politician and at times a government official. He warned that because the target would be well protected, the CS would not only have to conscript the trigger pullers, but also a woman to perform reconnaissance, and then have 25 randos foment a protest on the day of the killing, a distraction that would draw law enforcement attention away from the gunman. On camera, Merchant could be seen placing objects on a napkin to map out various assassination scenarios and, according to an unsealed search warrant, repeatedly ask the CS to explain how the target would die. The following week, in Manhattan, the CS introduced Merchant to two supposed hitmen, both FBI undercovers. Merchant indicated he wanted them to kill somebody, a target he described as a political person. He would later arrange payment of a $5,000 advance for the job. Finally, Merchant reportedly told the assassins he would be departing the country and that they would receive instructions, including the target's name, in August or September. Merchant seemed better versed in operational security than the previous plotters had been. The CS was instructed to photograph and text to Merchant the serial number off of a dollar bill, which he was later asked to produce when he picked up the $5,000 in Queens. Merchant provided the CS with code words to use when communicating about the plot once Merchant was back overseas. In addition, according to a pretrial filing from the Deputy Attorney General, Merchant disclosed that he himself had been trained by the IRGC in counter-surveillance and other espionage tactics and kept in touch with his handler via messages hidden inside gift bags taken overseas by others to Pakistan. On July 12, 2024, after witnessing Merchant put luggage in the trunk of his car outside a residence in Houston, the FBI moved in and arrested him. Wray would later describe Merchant as a Pakistani national with close ties to Iran, who is straight out of the Iranian playbook. The day after that arrest, 1,200 miles away in Butler, Pennsylvania, 20-year-old Thomas Matthew Crooks fired 8 rounds from a rooftop overlooking a Trump rally, grazing the president, killing former firefighter Corey Comparator, and wounding 2 others. While officials have confirmed to me that Trump was indeed one of Merchant's targets, they insist the alleged recruiter had no known connection to Crooks or to Ryan Wesley Ruth, the construction worker whom a grand jury would charge with attempting to assassinate Trump in West Palm Beach. Neither the feds nor police in Pennsylvania or Florida have credibly linked the 2 men to Iran. 3 days after Butler, on July 16th, Shikari, according to an FBI affiant, was back online, using a Maldives-registered phone number to text Pop Rivera, telling him to take care of it already, which officials believe was yet another order to kill Alinejad. The two men reputedly discussed the $100,000 bounty again, and Shikari added with urgency, "Just do it, son. I'll handle the rest." Weeks passed without incident on the Alinejad front. However, on September 30th, Shikari, from his perch in Tehran, had the first of 5 telephone conversations with the FBI. His stated reason for reaching out was to seek a sentence reduction for someone serving time in U.S. custody. The details of his calls, as laid out in a November 8th complaint, are fascinating and frightening. By his own admission, Shikari met more than a dozen times at various restaurants around the Iranian capital with an IRGC official who knew the ex-con had previously lived in New York. They discussed Alinejad, whom prosecutors refer to as Victim 1, and at some point the official indicated the IRGC wanted her killed immediately and would pay approximately $1.5 million. But there was a catch. Shikari, or whomever he hired for the hit, would have to produce videotaped proof confirming Alinejad's death and showing that Shikari's team was responsible for it. Evidently, authorities surmise, Iran had enough other hitmen going after Alinejad that they needed visual corroboration from the actual killer or recruiter himself. The IRGC official is also said to have requested that Shikari arrange for the killing of 2 prominent Jewish business people in New York City, Victim 2 and Victim 3, and signaled a willingness to pay $500,000 for each hit. Finally, according to a warrant seeking Shikari's arrest, he supposedly told the Bureau that in September, the IRGC official ordered him to put aside his other efforts on behalf of the IRGC and focus on surveilling and ultimately assassinating former President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, described in the filing as Victim 4. When the ex-con pointed out to his handler that the cost would be huge, he allegedly was told money's not an issue. The FBI took this to mean that the IRGC previously had spent a significant sum of money on efforts to murder Victim 4 and was willing to continue spending a lot of money in its attempt to procure Victim 4's assassination. For the Iranians, the clock was ticking. On or about October 7th, Shikari's contact, according to the filings, directed him to provide a plan within 7 days to kill Victim 4, and suggested that were he unable to do so, the IRGC would pause its plan to kill Victim 4 until after the U.S. presidential elections because Shakiri evidently claimed his IRGC handler assessed that Victim 4 would lose the election and in its wake would be easier to assassinate. But Biden Justice Department has acknowledged it kept Trump apprised of the alleged plots, along with attempts to hack into the Trump campaign's communications. Trump's team was reportedly briefed by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and Trump would post on Truth Social, "Big threats on my life by Iran. Moves were already made by Iran that didn't work out, but they will try again." It was later revealed that America's nemesis responded privately to Biden's accusations. According to officials in Washington and Tehran, a message from Iran was conveyed through a third party to the Biden administration, insisting that it was not engaged in plots to assassinate the former president. Regardless, the cases against the alleged plotters are proceeding in federal court. Meanwhile, in the months since the election, Iran, even as its representatives have spoken out about wanting to re-engage with the U.S. and its allies on a nuclear arms agreement, has reportedly accelerated its nuclear efforts and is producing weapons-grade uranium. London calling. In December, Weiner and a small contingent flew to London to reunite with their counterparts from various security services, MI5, SO15, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, RCMP, and the FBI. The occasion was a private ceremony commemorating their collective role in Operation Outlands, a sensitive and sophisticated tripartite takedown of a terrorist who had bedeviled authorities for decades. Weiner had scheduled several meetings during the visit, and, as is typical in her peripatetic life, she stopped before heading off to a dinner to call into a parent-teacher conference back home. The specifics of Operation Outlands and its endgame have been closely guarded. I can say with confidence that this case has brought the most significant public safety benefit I've seen in my 20 years in counterterrorism, said Dominic Murphy, when we sat down at New Scotland Yard on the north bank of the Thames. As chief of SO15, the Metropolitan Police's counterterror command, the bespectacled 52-year-old thought he had seen it all. "We've disrupted 43 late-stage plots since 2017, people imminently wanting to launch terror attacks." And yet Anjem Chowdhury remained such a focus that you could never drop your eye. If the name does not ring a bell, Chowdhury's legacy almost certainly will. He is the co-founder and emir of a designated terrorist organization known as Al-Muhajirun, ALM, and his acolytes, British citizens inspired by his glorification of violent jihad, are connected to, among other things, the 2013 decapitation of British soldier Lee Rigby, and both the 2017 London Bridge and 2019 Fishmongers Hall attacks. Chowdhury has also been a prolific recruiter, persuading hundreds of people in the UK to travel abroad to join ISIS. Among the more insidious of the Mujahideens was a British-born convert named Siddhartha Dhar, who, after serving as Chowdhury's close aide and ALM's spokesman, moved his family to Syria, where he became a key English-language propagandist for ISIS, and is suspected of having appeared in one of the group's gruesome on-camera execution videos. In 2017, the U.S. Treasury Department named Chowdhury a specially designated global terrorist. For Weiner, the London trip had been 18 years in the making. "It was my first case as a baby analyst," she said, referring to a complicated British-born network she tried to pin down when she first joined the NYPD. Long before they would find direct linkages to Chowdhury, Weiner and her colleagues were playing a frustrating game of whack-a-mole with what they characterized as a U.S. affiliate in New York, the Islamic Thinkers Society, ITS. We called it a bug light, where these guys would come in and radicalize and then go on and get arrested. Stopping Chowdhury proved particularly challenging. The charismatic cleric with a law degree was careful not to overstep UK counterterrorism statutes in his sermons and other public statements. And when the country banned ALM in 2005, he strategically rebranded. Weiner and various team members kept close watch nonetheless. The hide-and-seek continued until July 2014, when footage appeared of Chowdhury swearing allegiance to ISIS and its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The Brits convicted Chowdhury for inviting support for the proscribed organization known as ISIS. Following his 2018 release from prison, Chowdhury was barred for a time from using the internet, public speaking, or associating with extremists. Once those conditions expired, Weiner remembered, he was back to communicating with the Islamic Thinker Society, so our undercover started engaging with him directly. It would take her and her foreign partners years to bring him to justice. Weiner arranged for me to meet with the case agents, who were in town to receive the commander's commendation from SO15, for what Murphy would describe as their tenacity, courage, professionalism, and detective ability. At noon, on a gloomy December afternoon, four members of Weiner's SSU filed into my hotel room. Since the department, as noted, has never publicly acknowledged the SSU or described its operations, having them surface in a London hotel was a bit of a thing. Before sitting down on a couch, 377, the undercover at the center of the case, was put off by the silence. He turned on the television, explaining that they were trained never to meet without background noise, a tactic to frustrate would-be eavesdroppers. Undercover 337 was accompanied by Charlie, his handler Kevin, who supervises undercover operations, and Deborah, the analyst on the Chowdhury case. My request to record the conversation for clarity was met with some serious side-eye, as was the entirely coincidental appearance on a shelf behind me of a large coffee table book entitled Vanity Fair 100 Years. One of them gave me a quizzical look that suggested I might have planted it there. It was clear that they had never met with a journalist. They certainly seemed to be tight teammates. As they spoke, Charlie and 377 finished each other's sentences. A practicing Muslim, 377 had a devil-may-care bearing. He told me that he had so thoroughly infiltrated the American chapter of ITS that he had been promoted to serve as the muscle responsible for vetting those in the U.S. who sought to join. It was the perfect cover, allowing him to turn away dilettantes or to closely watch hardcore ideologues who might pose a real threat. ITS is an incubator, Kevin said. It provides an environment where someone who self-radicalizes can meet like-minded people and then go join a foreign terrorist organization. Deborah added, we've locked up 11 ITS members who were preparing to travel abroad to join ISIS. For 8 years, 377 remained operational inside the U.S.-based ITS movement, where he participated in and reported back on conversations and video conferences with Chowdhury and a handful of other true believers, as well as larger gatherings of 150 or more. The undercover also took to the streets for Dawah, a traditionally peaceful form of proselytizing that ITS firebrands had turned into provocative stunts to demonstrate that the group was practicing authentic Islam. Doing Dawah was risky, 377 told me. We'd show up on a street corner in the Bronx with signs looking to incite violence. Chowdhury came to trust and rely on 377. As ITS accounts were shuttered on various platforms, including StreamYard, Zoom, and Discord, the British imam directed the American undercover to create a channel on Telegram, which Chowdhury apparently believed was more secure. We saw this uptick of activity after he got released, and we saw him kind of back to his own old tricks, Weiner recalled. We started passing our intelligence to the Brits. Hey, just by the way, this guy is now directing our meetings, and he is back. For their part, Canada's RCMP was running its own undercover, who was monitoring Khalid Hussein, Chowdhury's Edmonton-based personal assistant, who would exchange candid voice notes with his boss, including one he shared with a Canadian agent, describing ITS as being al-Muhajiron. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. And a bit of ancient advice. Beware the Ides of March.